Otsi et al. Versus Carter et al.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm here today on behalf of Dean Carter. Dean Carter is entitled to qualified immunity on this First Amendment claim for two reasons. The first is that plaintiffs did not prove that the law with regard to college students' First Amendment rights for student-sponsored...
Her red light is on, please.
...for student-sponsored publications was clearly established at the time that Dean Carter made her phone calls, or even today for that matter. And the other reason is that the plaintiffs failed to provide enough evidence to support a jury finding on each element of a prior restraint claim. Your Honor, the qualified immunity question, the fundamental question, is whether every reasonable university administrator would have been compelled to conclude that Dean Carter's conduct, her phone calls to the printer, were unconstitutional.
Didn't Carter admit that a college newspaper is a public forum?
I don't think she did, Your Honor, and even if she had, she's not a court. I mean, I don't think her opinion...
She's talking about her theory of the case.
Right. In her theory of it? Do you mean in the briefs, Your Honor? Or do you mean Dean Carter herself?
In the court.
I'm sorry?
Didn't she admit that a college newspaper is a public forum?
She herself? I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. Do you mean she herself or in the briefs? She herself?
Yes.
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. But even if she had, Your Honor, as I was saying, her view of whether the newspaper was a public forum in the legal sense, she's not a lawyer, wouldn't really matter. I mean, courts have to decide these questions, and these are very, very intensive, as the Hazelwood Court said. These are very fact-intensive inquiries.
What does the record tell us about control over the content of the innovator? Judge Conlon said that, here's what she said, that the student editors and writers are given complete editorial control over the newspaper, including its subject matter and content. Does the record support that conclusion?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it does. The record says that, and this was undisputed, this is one of the undisputed facts, is that there was the common practice was that the advisor would sign off on the paper. Now, this protected the university, as Ms. Hosky said in her deposition. This was designed to protect the university from liability. Obviously, the university, this is university-sponsored speech. The innovator's subtitle is the newspaper of Governor State University.
Okay, even if the faculty advisor had to sign off on each issue of the paper before it's submitted to the printer, is there evidence in the record suggesting that he or she, what was he had the ultimate power to determine content, or was he simply an advisor?
He was an advisor, but he had sign-off, and the sign-off power, and there was apparently another level of sign-off as well, according to the evidence. And this level of sign-off power, there's no evidence in the record to show that the paper could have gone, that the publisher could have printed it without this sign-off. And again, whether Dean Carter...
Sign-off means to approve everything in the paper.
That's my understanding. I mean, there's nothing in the record that contradicts that.
Well, yes, there might be, and let me see.
Okay.
Because Ms. According to Ms. Hosty, the innovator historically has been totally student-run.
Mm-hmm.
That was the quote.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on summary judgment, don't we have to credit that testimony, and doesn't that evidence suggest that the innovator is, or at least might be, a limited public forum? And, I mean, as the editor of the paper, doesn't she have personal knowledge of that subject?
Your Honor, even if that were true, even if there were evidence to support the limited public forum, which frankly I do not think there is, but if the court disagrees, that doesn't change the analysis either for the merits or for the qualified immunity analysis. You have to look at what the landscape was in 2000. In 2000, what you had was Hazelwood, which said school-sponsored publications when they're
high school.
Right, but
not
Hazelwood.
A big difference here?
I'm sorry?
Not a big difference.
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court was very careful. They said we don't have to decide right now whether this is what we would also apply to college students. And then in 1999, a year before Dean Carter's phone calls, the Sixth Circuit came out with the Kincaid decision. And what the Sixth Circuit said was that not just review and approval, but that the university could confiscate the yearbook there based on form and content objections. So that's the only post-Hazelwood university case on a similar subject. The only case after Dean Carter's phone calls is the Brown case from just this last August, where you have three different decisions from the Ninth Circuit judges. The one says that the Hazelwood, the forum analysis applies to the student's thesis, that the school could censor the student's thesis based on objections to its content. Judge Reinhardt said, this is an open question. We don't know what the standard is for First Amendment rights for college students. And if it's an open question in the Ninth Circuit, there's no law to show that it's a closed question in the Seventh Circuit or in the United States Supreme Court, or that there's any kind of consensus. The Sixth Circuit flip-flopped on this question. I mean, went a total reversal of opinion. And that's because this is a very, very fact-based inquiry. And if you all, both the first Kincaid court, the panel said, this is a non-public forum. You look at the supervision, you look at the policy of the university. Now, here the policy of the university, and there's no question about this, is that the advisor got to sign off. And our contention is that there is no constitutional distinction between Dean Carter saying, we want someone from the administration to sign off, and there being an advisor signing off. There simply is not. Now, also, as to the merits, I'd just like to make a few points. I see them into my rebuttal time. There's no evidence that the speech that was being suggested was constitutionally protected. The plaintiffs are saying they have the First Amendment right to write anything they want in the student newspaper of the university. This is simply not true. There's no constitutional right to deceptive speech. There's no constitutional right to slander. There's no constitutional right to quite a few things. In addition, there's no evidence that they were denied access. There's a giant constitutional difference between review and denial of access. Furthermore, there's no evidence that there was a content-based discrimination. Ms. Porche said at her deposition at page 180 and 181, she had never been told that she could not write, that they could not write about a subject by any defendant. Ms. Porche said that the defendants did not know whether the defendants knew about the investigations, and that's at page 126, I believe, and 24 of her deposition. So, Your Honors, there's no evidence to support every element of the prior restraint claim, and the law is so unsettled in this area that we would like this court to give us guidance when it reverses the entry of summary judgment for Dean Carter.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel, Your Honors, on behalf of the amici, we appreciate the opportunity to appear before this court and present oral arguments in support of the position for the students at Governor State, the plaintiffs' appellees in this case. On behalf of those plaintiffs and appellees, on behalf of the amici, we urge this court to affirm the decision of the district court below denying Dean Carter's motion for summary judgment. We urge, Your Honors, and we think that the court got it right when the court determined that the dean was not entitled as a matter of law to judgment in her favor to support a motion for summary judgment.
Mr. Kohler, the Supreme Court in Hazelwood stated that a school has an interest in disassociating itself from speech that is ungrammatical, poorly written, and inadequately researched, among
yes.
other things. Even the dissenters agreed on that point.
Yes.
The court didn't say that it was only talking about high school. Is it your position that a university, in contrast to a high school or an elementary school, lacks the right to disassociate itself from speech that is rife with errors?
Your Honor, when you would include that point that the court raises in the factual context in Hazelwood, it's important to recognize that in Hazelwood, putting aside for a moment high school versus university, I think the court indicated that there is a huge difference there. But when you talk about student publication that is part of a curriculum, that is part of a classroom setting, where there is teaching going on with respect to the publication, then absolutely the school would have an interest then in making sure that the principles taught are being followed. That's clearly not the context here with respect to the innovator, which some of the questions had indicated it was not part of a curriculum. And
but it was a school-sponsored newspaper.
It's a school-supported, funded newspaper, but by policy. And there is evidence in the record, express policy at GSU that said this student publication would be student-controlled and student-edited. That's clear in the record.
But wouldn't a university have a keen interest in ensuring that the newspaper at the least meets the basic standards of spelling and grammar? I mean, would you concede that some of the spelling and grammatical errors are egregious for a university newspaper?
Judge, I honestly, and again, not being part of the record below, but what I've seen in the course of a record, in course of all of the student publications, examples of the innovator that were in the record, would this be egregious? I don't think so. There's going to be mistakes made. There's going to be grammatical mistakes made. There's going to be mistakes made in the briefs that highly educated counsel present to this court. Mistakes will be made. Is it egregious? I don't think so. Would not agree to that. There are going to be mistakes made. But if we go to the public forum analysis, and by its intent, its policy, and its practice to make this at least a limited or designated public forum, then this university loses its right, we would submit, to do the censorship and the prior restraint that this dean of students, I think that's where, if we're going to talk about egregious conduct, that's where the egregious conduct
is. Well, tell me this. Do you agree with the plaintiff that reviewing the paper for such things as spelling and... tell me this. Can spelling and grammar be divorced from substance?
I think, Your Honor, when in the context of this case, when a dean of students wants to review on allegedly on that basis, when it's clear that it's content driven, I don't think it can be divorced from substance. And again, the context of the factual record before this court.
So, in other words, you wouldn't agree that reviewing the papers, for. Spelling and grammar amounts to a content-based.
I think it would
review.
Amount to a content-based review.
So you will.
I think what the record shows in this case, Your Honor, with respect to the advisor at issue here, that person was in place for advice to go to. That person, I don't believe that. And again, I'm not as familiar with the record as my opponent, not being involved in the court below. But there clearly is a dispute with respect to what this advisor was doing or not doing, and it's our position, and our students have said under oath that advisor was in place to go to for advice, not to prior restraint, not to censor content or subject of the paper.
So you're talking about Mr. Bell now?
Whoever the advisor was other than Dean Carter, correct.
I don't know. Cases like Kincaid and Brown really do reflect the ongoing uncertainty regarding the extent to which Hazelwood applies in the university setting. Why would it have been clear to Dean Carter that Hazelwood didn't entitle her to review future issues of the innovator for stylistic error?
Your Honor, I think it was very clear to Dean Carter what the status of the law was when she made those calls to the publisher, and for her to, after the fact, say
no
that there was
some confusion. No one else is. None of the circuits are. Why would Dean Carter?
I think Dean Carter had, in this circuit, the Fujishima case. Clearly, when you're looking at an action that is prior restraint, a call to a printer to stop the presses, to seek prior review. She knew exactly what she was doing was in violation of the law. And in fact, Your Honor, on this motion for summary judgment context, I think the affidavits of Charles Richards and Pat Beatty from the printing company, the regional publishing company, are clear that they told her, Mr. Richards told Dean Carter, and this is the CEO of the largest printing company in the United States, printing student newspapers, said, no, your actions are against the law. It was clear to the printer of the newspaper. It should have been clear to this experienced dean of student life that her actions were a prior restraint. In the broader context of Neer versus Minnesota, it's nearly an absolute ban against what she was asking to do. Putting aside outside of the context of student publications for a moment, Neer versus Minnesota makes her actions clearly unconstitutional. When you put it in the context of this circuit, the Fujishima precedent, I think that's clear. There's nothing to indicate that that wasn't a clear precedent that she should have known about and she should have applied.
If a paper is published and the and everybody objectively agrees that it's full of spelling errors and grammatical errors and so on, the university then could, after publication, could withdraw funding and close the newspaper down, couldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, again, from the Rosen...
Saying it reflects poorly on how we're educating our students because they're putting out a poor product like this.
Your Honor, disagree completely under the U.S. Supreme Court standard in Rosenberger, which clearly involved an issue of funding of student publication. I think that would be clearly viewed as content-based, and I think it would be unconstitutional.
Why is my example content-based? If it's solely based on the grammatical errors and misspellings that the university believes reflect poorly on it, if this is viewed as the voice of the students of the university.
Your Honor, I think there are prior cases talking about that kind of scrutiny as being, in fact, content-based actions.
How is that content?
What are those cases?
Your Honor, I believe we've cited them
in a point that you're making.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think it goes to the question that was asked earlier. I mean, can you really divorce these issues in the context of the public forum analysis? I just don't think that you can.
Well, I'm sure if you found you looked hard enough and found spelling errors in some articles that were critical of the university, that's one thing. But if you're right, university newspaper was writing articles about what should be the state flower or something like that, something totally uncontroversial and had all kinds of errors in it, why would the university have to continue if that was a pattern and they wanted to close it down without violating the First Amendment?
Well, I think, Your Honor, I'm not sure how to answer that other than to say that I think that action would violate the First Amendment, and also to answer that question by saying, and again to make it clear to this court, while there's been some argument from the other side that the innovator was somehow an example of just a poorly run or a grammatically incorrect newspaper. And again, I don't think that the evidence in the record supports that at all.
I guess I'm having trouble with the content versus structure of the article. And I gather from your answer to my question that you view everything as content, even though my questions I was asking you about strictly spelling errors and grammatical errors.
And again, I think when the if the university would pull its funding on the basis of that, that would be viewed as content-based and would be unconstitutional.
I can't see that.
And again, Your Honor, in terms of the issues in this case, I mean, that's not the issue that's before this court. The issue before this court is whether this defendant appellant has sustained her burden on appeal to establish that the district court was incorrect in denying her motion for summary judgment. I think on the basis of the factual record, and again, the court indicated that on the basis of the affidavits, the basis of the testimony of the students, there's no way that the dean can survive any factual disputes that she has tried to create. And again, as a matter of law, we think that the law clearly is well established that her actions constituted a prior strength. I do see that I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you for your questions.
Counsel, all right. You have one minute, please.
All right. In answer to Judge Evans' question, in fact, yes, for non-content-based reasons, we could close the forum, and you'll find that in our brief, we're citing Cornelius in our opening brief at page 19 and 20. With regard to Rosenberger, that was about viewpoint discrimination. There's never been any question that there was never any hint that there was viewpoint discrimination here. Neer versus Minnesota was a 1931 United States Supreme Court case, which just says the regular yes, yes, First Amendment. But what you have to do is look for clearly established law. You have to look at something that's like this case. And what's like this case is Hazelwood and the first Kincaid case. Counsel said that Jean Carter should have known from what Richards told her. Richards is a printer, and yes, he might be the head of the biggest printer in Chicago or for school papers, but he's a printer. He's not a court, and as far as I know, he's not even a lawyer. And I would not take legal advice from someone who is not a lawyer, and I would prefer to take my legal advice from the Seventh Circuit or the United States Supreme Court. With regard to, counsel also said that it matters whether it's a classroom. It doesn't matter. Hazelwood was very clear about this. As long as it's sponsored by the school, as long as there's supervision, as long as there's an educational purpose, then it's school-sponsored and it's a limited forum. With that in mind, I see my time is up, and we ask this court to reverse on the basis of qualified immunity. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Allowed versus the United States.
Good morning, Your Honor.
We don't wait for counsel. Is the government's counsel here in this case? All right.
Good morning, may it please you. Please record.
This is not a reflection on the lack of interest in your appeal. Everybody's leaving before you're getting a chance to talk.
It might be. Richard Trace, on behalf of the petition, Ms. Awad. One way or another, Ms. Awad has been in these proceedings for a number of years, has been in the United States since 1988, and as Your Honors, I'm sure, are aware, had withdrawn her claims for asylum and suspension of deportation at her immigration judge hearing with the full expectation that she was going to adjust her status by virtue of a marriage to a United States citizen, and was granted 1 year voluntary departure. During that year, she did not adjust her status to a United States citizen because they got divorced. And then, within that year of her voluntary departure, sought to reopen the matter and once again pursue, one way or another, her prior claims for asylum and or suspension of deportation. As the law changed during that period in 1996, the immigration judge felt that in the motion to reopen ruling that the petitioner now had failed to establish the requisite time period for continuous residence in this country. And on that issue, through a number of decisions, we're asserting that she did, at the time of the judge's decision, have the requisite number of years, the 7 years, even though there was an order to show cause issued prior to that seventh year, because at that time the order to show cause issued prior to the seventh year of continuous residence did not in fact stop the or toll the continuous residence period, and did allow the petitioner at that time to pursue her suspension of deportation application. A number of laws have been enacted since then, and a number of cases indicating that, in fact, the time-stop rule would bar her from the suspension of deportation case. We've, in this brief, have indicated the Ninth Circuit's point of view in a couple of cases where the petitioner's immigration judge decision was made prior to the effective date of the act, which is April 1st, 1997, and that those decisions should reflect the petitioner's opportunity to pursue the suspension of deportation application, because the law simply wasn't in effect at that time, and any amendments thereto through the NACARA subsequent laws wouldn't apply yet because the law wasn't in effect yet. That seems to be the rationale.
Now, she never appealed from the 2001 order from the board which addressed the application of the time stop rule, did she?
That's correct, Judge.
Did she raise the stop time rule in her motion to reconsider?
In the final motion to reconsider, we didn't raise that issue because the board had indicated its position on that issue. We raised the asylum issue, trying to get that opened as well. We were trying to go on both grounds.
But don't we lack jurisdiction to address the issue of the stop time?
One of the problems that immigration bar faces, I think, in these cases is to avoid prematurely bringing these cases to the Seventh Circuit, we frequently bring the cases back to the BIA on maybe other issues that might be relevant and accept the decision of the board as it is without a motion to reconsider, indicating that there's no other facts or law to reconsider. We may believe they're wrong in their decision, but it might be fruitless at that point to reconsider that issue. And so we abstain or hold back from bringing motions to reconsider on those issues, and at the same time also abstain from bringing the cases here. And then we bring the cases back on maybe another issue that might be relevant, the asylum issue, to reopen that one, hoping that that might reopen the case and avoid coming to this court as well. And so, given the board's decision regarding the suspension of deportation claim, I think there is some authority for the fact that the law was not in effect at the time that the immigration judge made his decision, and that at that time the Ms. Awa did have her requisite 7 years, which would allow her for suspension of deportation. If there are any questions, I'll just reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
All right, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, members of the court. I'm Paul Fiorino for the INS. Judge Rovner, you're absolutely right. This court lacks jurisdiction over the stop time issue. What is at issue before this court this time is solely the final ruling of the BIA with respect to asylum. And the board was completely within its jurisdiction and was within its discretion to decide as it did, because the petitioner adduced virtually no evidence evidencing eligibility for asylum. She had not met the requirements of new, previously unavailable evidence supported by affidavits or other admissible evidence. So the board was completely within its jurisdiction, and this court doesn't have any jurisdiction to decide anything before that. If there's one case that the government did not mention in its brief, and I apologize to the court, but it's Stone versus INS, it's a Supreme Court case, 514 U.S. 386. Justice Kennedy wrote in the majority opinion, and I'll give you a very brief sentence of what he said. We conclude that the statute is best understood as reflecting an intent on the part of Congress that deportation orders are to be reviewed in a timely fashion after issuance, irrespective of the later filing of a motion to reopen or reconsider. And that is at 514 U.S. 394. So the Supreme Court has clearly spoken to this issue. And even so, if the issue of the stop time were properly before this court, we would submit that that issue has been decided against the petitioner. We cited the Angel Ramos case. The petitioner cites the St. Cyr case as in support of his assertion that the stop time rule is impermissibly retroactive. We would assert that St. Cyr is clearly distinguishable for two reasons. Number one, St. Cyr had to do with a criminal alien pleading guilty in reliance on eligibility for relief from deportation, which is not the case here. But more importantly, because St. Cyr found that Congress did not intend retroactive application of the repeal of 212C, whereas it clearly has with respect to the retroactive application of the stop time rule. Subject to the court's questions, the government submits the court should affirm the decision of the BIA.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Just a couple points. As I indicated earlier, I think it would be unfair to discourage the petitioner here from and other petitioners from filing motions to reconsider or motions to reopen and immediately pursue the petition for review, if I say that right. In other words, if the ruling is that we can't go back into the heart of the case, the real deportation order here, we're encouraging everyone to file their petitions for review immediately upon those decisions, and we're foreclosing the opportunity, I think, to go back and file motions to reconsider. I think we're going to lose issues that way, lose our rights on that issue. And secondly, the board in its decision indicated they weren't sure if it was the old asylum or a new asylum claim from which we were asserting. There was only one asylum claim filed, and that was before the immigration judge. That I thought was obvious. That was filed back, I believe, in 95. And the one that was withdrawn, we attempted to reopen. And the judge, I think, knew that because in his opinion, he indicates that we expected to go forth on the adjustment of status, and that was the reason that we withdrew those applications at that time. And that we only withdrew those applications to make matters again easier. Instead of going through a full-scale hearing in asylum or suspension of deportation, which takes a day of the court's time, we indicated with the judge, who had an agreement with the counsel, that we'll take a year of voluntary departure and hopefully adjust status through the marriage. That was the plan. It didn't happen, and then we thought we could revert back to our prior position, hoping to suffer no prejudice from doing that. I just want to point that to the court, and that the immigration judge is fully aware of that, because he indicates that in his opinion that he, what we expected to do.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement. This will be case number 5. Neil and Brandon versus NLH.
May it please the court. This action was originally instituted under the Labor Management Relations Act by the plaintiffs as separate causes of action against both their union and their employer. They settled the cause of action with their union, and subsequently their employer filed a motion for summary judgment claiming that the plaintiffs could provide no proof that the union breached its duty of fair representation. Obviously, under the case law that has come down from Baca versus Sipes, proof has to be provided both that the union breached its duty of fair representation and that the employer breached its contract in order for the plaintiff to recover. Obviously, the motion for summary judgment issues are generally whether there are any material facts in dispute and whether there is a genuine issue That is, whether a reasonable jury could find that the union was arbitrary or perfunctory in failing to file or prosecute the grievances on behalf of the plaintiffs in this matter. The action for Neal is based on the fact that the employer had a policy of calling in to report illnesses. Neal did so on two consecutive days. The employer claimed he did not do so. The union steward discovered that there was a taped call-in of by Neal for those 2 days. He reported it to the employer. The employer refused to rescind the termination, and the union steward did not file a grievance.
Mr. Baer, did either of the plaintiffs meet with his foreman within 5 days, as required by the collective bargaining agreement?
Well, I submit that they did, because Neal was fired by his foreman when he returned after the second day of illness. Brandon was also fired by his foreman when he returned to work the next morning after his previous night's work. So I think that constitutes a meeting.
I have a problem with the structure of this case. Why the union is no longer a party. So you settled with the union. So the company is in the position of having to argue that the union provided fair representation. Ordinarily, the company would not know everything that the union did, what the discharge worker, the disciplined worker, said to the union steward, what the union people discussed. I think it's very odd to have one of these hybrid cases without the union being a party and arguing that its representation was
adequate. Case law provides that you can sue either party, but you have to make proof that they both committed a wrong.
I've had a hard time, and I don't know if there are cases where the union hasn't been a party to a claim of failure to fairly represent.
Well, for economic reasons, the plaintiffs settled with the union. That I don't think that made the case any different than it would have been if the union had been in it.
I mean, are you aware of cases under these hybrid type of cases where the union is no longer a party?
I don't recall a citation, but in my research, I ran across one case in which they said, and I think there was just a suit filed against either the employer or the union. The court said you still have to prove that both a breach of contract and a breach of the duty of fair representation, but you can just sue one party if that's your choice.
Okay.
But you have to make the same proof to recover against both of them, even if they're in the same case. The situation with Brandon was that he was scheduled to work until 10 o'clock at night, and again at 6 a.m. the next morning. He was ordered to work at 9:45 the night before. He didn't do so. He left when his shift ended, and then he was terminated the next day. Now, the sub-issue in this is whether or not the employer has a right to mandatorily require overtime when it has partially negotiated overtime by having a provision in the contract that it can have employees work 3 10-hour days when it is providing for commercial work. And also, when you juxtapose that against 29 USC 158, which provides that there's a duty on both the employer and the union to mutually bargain with respect to any employment issues. And there's no evidence in this case that the employer sought to bargain that. So it's
so why didn't the employees file their request in a timely manner?
Well, they requested the union steward to file grievances on their behalf. And it's our position that it's a fiduciary duty of the union steward as the exclusive representative to take that action.
Without them filing a request in writing?
Right. I think the request can be made orally.
Is that in the union contract? Did you look it up?
No, I don't know if that's in the union contract. There's no...
In other words, it's your theory that the union has an obligation to file a grievance, even though they see no merit to it.
Oh, not in that instance. There's no question. In that instance, there don't. But there's never been a determination made by the union in this case that these terminations were...
Well, every disciplined employee then has is entitled to a hearing, to a grievance procedure?
No, the union can make a determination whether or not the grievance has merit. But they didn't make that determination in this case.
Well, how would they make it if they didn't have a request according to their own rules?
Well, they had a request by their union members, Neil and Brandon.
Orally, you say.
Right.
And in a timely fashion.
And in a timely fashion.
Right.
Now, there's a tripartite standard for determining, I guess that my end's my...
You're into your rebuttal time.
Okay. All right. The issue is whether or not the union was arbitrary or perfunctory in carrying out its representation in this case, and we submitted this, and I'll reserve whatever time I have for rebuttal.
Thank you. All right, counsel.
Good morning, members of the panel, and may it please the court. I believe, listening to the comments earlier, that this really is a unique case where the employer is arguing that the union did its job. But as you understand, the state of the law for the plaintiff is they must show both that the union breached its duty of fair representation and to prevail that the employer breached the agreement. From our perspective, for newspaper holdings, we believe, quite frankly, in arguing the district court got it right in granting summary judgment. There was presented on behalf of plaintiff Neal only the issue of the union's duty of fair representation. As the plaintiff Brandon, the employer presented the union duty of fair representation and the second prong that there was no breach of the collective bargaining agreement. Based on this working overtime question, the district court did not rule on Brandon's cases to the employer's breach of contract issue because it had already found there was no union duty breach, so it felt it did not have to get there. I would just mention to this court, if you consider the issue de novo, as you have the right, that the case of the contract breach is not there, and I would cite the Trinka versus Local Union 688 that you just have an argument. You don't really even have a colorable claim. In fact, the record below, the employer presented expert testimony as to the rights of the employer to require overtime where the contract is silent as it is, And people forget, or the record shows, that Brandon was working his regular shifts, those shifts he gets by exercising his seniority rights under the collective bargaining agreement. Also, would point out specifically here in 2001, the McLeod versus Aero Marine Transport case by this court covers several of the points. Neil, in fact, did not ever file a grievance. Brandon, through his attorney, filed one, I believe, 7 weeks after his termination. Therefore, as to Neil, you look at McLeod, not filing a grievance would be fatal to the employee. Also, you have to look at this issue of what the employees told the union. At most, by the record, they just told the union or the union steward, do everything you can. I don't think that fits within the direction that the employee is required to give to the union, both to fulfill the grievance, which in this case, it's undisputed, the union had a practice that plaintiffs had followed, that to initiate the grievance process, the employee had to fill out a written grievance form. And I would also point out that previous written grievances had been filed by these individuals.